Friday, and welcome to Minute 60 of the Great Escape Minute, the daily podcast where we dig into the Great Escape 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again to finish off this week is Dana Nachman, award-winning documentary director. Welcome back, Dana.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, we've had a lot of fun talking about the Great Escape all week, and we're now going to get to finish off the week.
Nice.
Continuing our conversation with Werner and Henley. So Minute 60 starts with Werner explaining why he only has 19 merit badges and goes all the way until Werner is concerned that he might be seen. Yesterday we were talking about the discussion that the two of them were having, and they touched upon the whole idea of the Boy Scouts. As I mentioned, I was a little surprised to hear that there actually were Boy Scouts in Germany at any point. Obviously, you know, once the war broke out, obviously it wasn't going to continue. So I did a little bit of research on this, and it actually shocked me what I learned. I mean, I learned that the Scouts started both in America and in Germany in 1910.
Huh.
And it was, it was a prominent youth organization all the way until it was banned in 1936 by the Nazi Party, because they didn't want to allow any type of youth organizations besides their own. Basically, the whole debate between the two of them about the number of merit badges, it's actually quite fascinating, because according to the Boy Scout Charter, someone who has 21 merit badges is considered an Eagle Scout, which is the highest ranking scout you can be. There are 7 different ranks that a scout can be. They can be a scout, a tenderfoot, second class, first class, star scout, life scout, and eagle scout, where they get all these different merit badges along the way and stuff like that. The choice of the screenwriter to have the debate between 19 and 20, it goes to show, I mean, obviously they didn't have Wikipedia back then, so they can look it up themselves about how many merit badges one needs to become an Eagle Scout.
Right.
The fact that they're one off from getting the highest rank is pretty coincidental, you know.
Yeah, that's definitely attention to detail there. That's the problem when I'm writing any screenplays or anything like that. I get so in the weeds of these things. I go down these, like, rabbit holes of information, and then I don't resurface. That's why I'm not a good screenwriter.
Right.
And I stick to directing.
But that's also, you know, you're talking 60 years ago.
Right.
You know, nowadays you can hire someone to do all the research, and you know they can do it online, or you can do it yourself. You know, back then
right.
it was a little more complicated.
Maybe the writer was was in the, you know, the organization.
Yeah, right.
But probably.
Their whole debate yesterday was between 19 and 20. They were trying to one up the other, you know, by saying that they, you know.
Yeah.
By Werner saying, I have 19, and he goes, oh, well, I had 20. And he goes, oh, I was working on my 20th when the government abolished scouting. And then this minute begins the continuation of that conversation, where he basically starts off by saying, well, I was, you know, once they abolished the scouting, and they sent me to the Hitler Youth instead. So that made me start wondering, I mean, Robert Graf, who plays the character of Werner, So we touched upon it a little bit this week, you know, how old Werner is supposed to be. You know, at one point, you know, a little later on in a week or two, Henley's going to say, oh, that kid's all mixed up. But, you know, first of all, James Garner is 10 years younger than Robert Graf is. Robert Graf is almost 40 at this point when they made the movie. But he's supposed to be quite young, because if he's mentioning the fact that he was in the Hitler Youth, you know, Hitler Youth was between the ages of 14 and 18. So
right.
Even by saying that in 1936, he was 18, so I guess the maximum that he could be, I mean, this movie takes place in 1944, so let's say that he's, you know, 24, 25. I mean, he doesn't look that way, obviously. He does look a little older than that. So it makes me question why they would give this part to someone who looks a lot older, because he doesn't look like he's a young kid.
No, he doesn't. He kind of has a youthful face, though. But yeah. It's a.
But I mean, he's not in his early to mid 20s. You can tell that.
No,
you can tell that quite easily by that. At this point, basically, Henley decides to change the subject a little bit, and he starts talking about him. Okay, what are you going to do after the war's over? You know, it's interesting that he's bringing up. You know, here you have two adversaries in a POW camp, and one of them says to the other, "What are you going to do when this is all over?" Meaning that, right. that they're thinking about the fact that, all right, this is something that will end soon, and we're going to all make it out alive, and we're going to, you know, continue with our lives. And what are you going to do? You know, are you going to become an army man? Are you going to stay in the army after the war or not? You know, Werner's response is, well, no, I'm not a well man, which doesn't really say much. I mean, you know, apparently he must have some sort of medical condition. I mean, he says that he has problems with his teeth. You know, I'm not a dentist or have never even thought about what type of problems people have with their teeth. That would say that someone in their 20s is not well.
Yeah.
You know, that's...
I wonder also if that was his way of asking how, you know, trying to get him to say, I'm not into the army anymore, you know, like trying to get information about him, or to see how sympathetic he'll be to their cause. Right. I wonder if that's part of what he was doing also.
Yeah, for sure. There's no question that's what he was trying to do here.
Yeah.
You know, but the idea also is that, you know, the guards that are in this prison camp are obviously not the elite of the elite. There's a reason
right.
why they're there.
So right.
apparently
right.
because of his medical issues, you know, whatever problems he seems to have with his teeth.
I know. Why would you choose teeth? Like, wouldn't you say, like, I guess, oh, well, I guess because he wants to portray that he's not cared for there.
Right.
Yeah.
But he's not cared for, but again, it turns, and then the question remains, why was he placed in this camp? Was he placed there because he's not well, because he has problems? Is he placed there because of connections that he has? And instead of, you know, putting him in the front, you know, they're going to put him, you know, in this
right.
cozy job, more or less, you know, guarding.
Where he's,
you know,
getting bribes.
Exactly. He gets chocolate and coffee and cigarettes.
Right.
Yeah, no, so it's just, it makes you wonder what exactly is the reason that he's here in this camp. And then he goes on a little bit of a diatribe about, you know, that he can tell him stories about his teeth. Which,
right.
which again, I don't want to hear stories about his teeth. You know, what is, you know, is it that he's got a lot of cavities? Is that a reason for someone to, you know, be considered not well? You know, back then, I don't know. I mean, can you think
yeah.
of any reasons that someone would, you know, be complaining about their teeth?
I mean, maybe if he got an infection, you know, he needed a root canal and he got an infection, but that seems like it's a temporary thing. It's not like a permanent condition.
Right.
So I don't know.
Yeah. No,
yeah.
It's, just,
it's a very strange
it's
thing.
It's a very strange thing to bring up here. There's no question
yeah.
about that. I mean,
yeah.
obviously he couldn't say, oh, I have problems with my heart or whatever it is, you know, because any type of major medical issue. So then they wouldn't have, you know, enlisted him, you know,
right.
he wouldn't have been put in the army at that point.
Right.
You know, teeth is just a very strange choice for him to say. And then he starts going on about saying, and he says, you know, I could tell you stories about my teeth that would make your hair stand on end.
Yeah.
Again, it doesn't really make much sense. And then he blurts out something that he realizes that he shouldn't have said. He goes, even our dentist here is a butcher. You know.
Yeah.
Which first of all, It tells us that you know, this is a small camp, but they still have a dentist there. You know, we never
right.
see any of the medical personnel from the German side. You know, we just see the guards
no.
and the officers you know, the ones that are running the camp. We don't see that they have, you know, auxiliary people with them. You know, they must have a doctor. Apparently they have a dentist also. You know, so they do have things that are being taken care of, even though they're in a small camp.
Right.
So even this line tells us a lot about the conditions for the soldier, for the guards in this type of camp. You know, the fact that they have a dentist, even though he's not happy about the dentist, you know, because he's a butcher.
Right.
And then he immediately goes, oh, wait, don't tell anyone I said that. You know, he starts getting a little, he realizes that he's going off
overshared.
A little too much. Exactly. You know.
Yeah.
A little bit of TMI.
Yep. Yes, for sure.
And then Henley actually has a very interesting comment to that. He goes, well, it's a soldier's right to complain.
Right.
Which reminded me from, you know, in you know, there's a whole conversation in Saving Private Ryan about complaining. You know, they have the, it's towards the beginning when they're all walking and they're continuing on, you know, they're starting on their mission. You know, Ryben starts complaining about the fact that they, you know, that they're being sent on this mission. At that point, Ryben says to Miller, he goes, he says, Captain, what about you? I mean, you don't gripe at all? And so Miller, played by Tom Hanks' response is as well, I don't gripe to you. I'm a captain. There's a chain of command. Gripes go up, not down. Always up. You gripe to me, I gripe to my superior officer, and so on and so on and so on. I don't gripe to you. I don't gripe in front of you. You should know that.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. So it's a great line because it does connect to
do you think that's typical of military life? Because I wouldn't know.
Of course.
Yeah.
Everyone likes, it's not just military life. It's any life, any part of life, you know, anyone.
But actually, I think in corporate life, you actually, it's the opposite. You complain, you wouldn't complain to your bosses because you'd be worried about it. You'd complain down, you know.
No, but if you need something, then you're going to complain up.
Right.
You're going to say,
right.
Oh, well, you know, we need more paper, you know, or whatever it right. is, you know, we need more funds for something. I don't know if complaint is the right term, but you're going to be moving up in the chain of command when you're dealing with problems.
Yes.
Because you don't necessarily complain to the people below you that the people above you aren't doing what they need to do.
Yeah. You more like gripe to them.
Yeah.
But you get stuff done with people above you.
Exactly.
Yeah. And you certainly don't do it to the people who, the prisoners that you're supposed to watch.
Yeah, for sure. That's definitely a no-no. You know, there are certain things that you don't do for, you know, I mean, obviously Werner's whole conversation here is a big no-no. He shouldn't be, you know, he shouldn't be giving away as much information as he's giving away. You know,
right.
Or just the idea that they're having this friendly conversation. They shouldn't be having this friendly conversation, you know, because then you deal with the whole Stockholm syndrome and things like that, you know, where you know, they're going to get too friendly when, you know, they shouldn't be, because sometimes...
Yeah, not good.
Sometimes guards need to do things that, you know, you can't be friends.
Right.
I mean, next week he mentions the line that he says, well, with you in the cooler, will we still be friends?
Right.
You know. So, you know, you have to find the place to draw the line between friendship and, you know, whether a guard is doing his duty. And,
right.
And then Werner's response, basically, it's great because he goes, well, maybe in your army, but not in ours. You know,
yeah, exactly.
Meaning in the German army, you don't complain. You do what they're told.
Or you're sent off.
Exactly. He goes, one little criticism and to the Russian front.
Not good.
Yeah. Not something that you want to do, and I love the way that he, you know, jerks with his thumb, you know, in the direction of, all right, one little complaint, then you're gonna off to the Russian front.
Yeah, no bueno.
Exactly, and Henley's response is he's feigning sympathy, but he's saying, "Is that so? Ooh, that's terrible."
Yeah. Yeah.
I wouldn't want to be in your army. That's what they're doing.
Yes, and they're so mean. Ours is much more benevolent.
Exactly, and Werner actually acknowledges it, but he just with his head, you know, he nods in agreement, but doesn't really, you know, he's being tight-lipped here.
He
realizes that he said a little too much, and doesn't want to continue with it. And then Henley starts walking around the room, smoking a cigarette. And then he calls Werner over and says, oh, well, why don't we go into our room?
He's continuing the seduction.
Exactly.
Seriously. Yesterday.
From earlier this week. He started with, you know, he started with the cigarettes. He started blowing smoke in his face. And now he wants to get him in the room.
Yeah.
You know, he goes, we can basically, let's go in the room because we can talk more carefully. And basically, Werner's response is, well, I better not because, you know, if Strachwitz, my superior, sees me, I'm going to get in a lot of trouble for that.
Right.
So we see that he's concerned about getting caught about doing this. I mean, as we'll see next week, he's apparently not that concerned. But he at least shows concern at this point before they continue to tempt him into, you know, doing more and getting out of there. Right. So, I mean, this whole minute is basically just the conversation between, or it ends the conversation between the two of them, you know, out in the common area. But it's also quite insightful because they give us a taste of, you know, how the prisoners would butter up the guards in order to get information from them. I mean, according to the real story, that did happen. They would have prisoners that it was their job to go and butter up the guards and glean information from them, you know, whenever they could.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of just having conversations is probably one of the best intel you can get.
Exactly. Even just to find out, well, where do you live? And, how long does it take you to get home by train? You know, just to get a little bit of an idea as to where they are, or, you know, other bits of information that you can get just by having a casual conversation.
Right.
So, I mean, obviously, we've discussed a number of days this week, this whole conversation between them. Basically a 3-minute scene, this conversation in the hallway, which probably in a modern movie they would cut that down. 3 minutes is a pretty long time to have this type of conversation, but it is effective in showing how he's getting this information.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. And he's such a good actor, and, you know, you just kind of want to watch him do this, you know, and the fact that they made it kind of a, you know, information, but a seduction is really clever. You know, the more sophisticated the storytelling in that perspective, the longer you can go.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So you have anything else since we're done with the minutes that we're discussing, is there anything else about the movie that you want to discuss a little bit about?
Let's see. I mean, the thing that I liked one of the most about this film wasn't in my 5 minutes, sadly, which was the music. I just thought was so great.
Well, there is music in these 5 minutes.
Oh, that's true, but yeah. It wasn't part of the score. So the score was done so interestingly, and I think really set the tone for the entire film. You know, it made it, you know, obviously had a patriotic bit to it, but was also very funny, you know, and it created this whimsy to it. And I think that that's obvious in a lot of ways that the director didn't want it to be a dark, depressing movie. I mean, if you think about, like, tonally, it could have been a very different movie, even with the script that they had. So I think the music was a big part of it. And I loved that about this film.
Yeah, because the 100%, I mean, the music that they have here, It constantly changes from being, you know, a funny tone to a somber tone to an adventurous tone. You know, it jumps around, and it gets you into the mood of that type of that type of scene that's going on. You know, you can even have a scene where, you know, part of the conversation, you know, they touch upon somber things, so there's somber music, and then, you know, something upbeat happens, and then the music completely changes direction along the way.
Yes. Yeah.
And they really, they do it amazingly.
No, it was great.
I'm still shocked that Elmer Bernstein wasn't nominated for anything for the music that he did in this movie.
I know. We should go back and listen to the scores of the Oscar winners of that year, because it's so crazy. Like, I wonder what did win, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's obviously easy for us.
Yeah. Yep.
To see what did win. But I'm just talking about the fact that it wasn't even nominated. I mean,
I know, but just to go listen to the other scores to see.
I mean, this movie, wow. The only thing that it was nominated for an Oscar was for film editing. And obviously it deserved that. There's no question about that. Okay, the scores that year, there were two categories. So there's one that's best musical score, substantially original. I don't really know. I guess it means it's... So you have Tom Jones, 55 Days at Peking, Cleopatra, How the West Was Won, and It's a Mad, Mad, Mad World. Tom Jones won that.
Huh.
And, ooh, this is interesting. The composer, John Addison, was not at the awards. And who accepted it in his place? Elmer Bernstein.
Oh, that's nice of him to go and not boycott because he didn't get
exactly. Wow.
Nominated.
That's very interesting. And then the second...
I would have boycotted.
So then the second category was best musical Best Music Scoring of Music or Adaptation or Treatment. And those were Irma LaDouche, A New Kind of Love, Bye Bye Birdie, Sundays and Sybil, and The Sword and the Stone. And the winner of that was Irma LaDouche.
Very cool.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us this week. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you. This was my first minute-by-minute experience.
I hope it's the first of many.
Yes, me too.
Yeah. I'll put the word out. Or actually, people will hear this, and they'll know that they can contact Dana Nachman, and she'll gladly join on the Movies by Minute to be able to discuss any movie they want to talk about.
That'll be fun.
Yeah, exactly. So do you want to once again tell people how they can get in contact with you?
Sure. My email is, or actually my website is dananachman, NACHMAN.com. And you can contact me through there.
All right, great. While you're doing that, you can rate, review, and subscribe on any podcatcher that you might be using to listen to this show. Our email address is thegreatminute@gmail.com. Our Facebook group is The Cooler. Our website is thegreatescapeminute.com. And our Twitter account is greatescapemxm. So, until Monday, tally-ho!
Tally-ho!